So this is the time to entertain questions, as I was telling you. So they better be entertaining. And yeah, more dialogue than anything. So please. As I say to the monks all the time, questions, comments, rebuttals.
Okay, I have an entertaining question.
Okay.
I hope. Where did they, and when, and why, did they decide to translate the word logos into the very inadequate word, word? It stumped me on the book of John for years until I began to look into it a little more deeply, into the exact meaning of logos. And I found it's so different from what you think of, word. Have we a voice-activated universe? Maybe, I don't know, but that's what it sounds like.
Yeah, that's not my area of expertise, but maybe the problem is not with the word, word, but that the problem is that we're thinking only of our small understanding of the word, word. You know, for example, in so many ancient languages, a word can have multiple levels of meaning. For example, there's this word purusha that's used in Sanskrit. And first of all, it means just, it can sometimes mean the male human being. And sometimes it means the person. Sometimes it means the inner person. Sometimes it means the archetype of the person. Sometimes it means the consciousness principle. Sometimes it means God as Purushatman, the great Purusha. And sometimes it means all those things at once. And that's part of the issue, is we only choose partial aspects of the meaning of it. So the word, word is not the problem. The problem is our understanding of the word.
And I think our language is a little bit inadequate.
But every language is. That's the problem with language, but it's all we got.
Well, when you look at the meaning of logos itself, it's not one word. Again, it's a principle. The principle
right.
by which the world was created, the divine
yeah.
principle. The
right.
Jews called it the divine principle.
Right.
And that's so different from our understanding, our tiny understanding of the word, word.
Yeah, but I think also the word logos or logismoi in Greek also has all those different meanings.
Very mathematical,
so
it, yes.
But it would be the same problem, and you'd have to have a sentence or a paragraph when, yeah. But I understand your frustration, but I think it's just the problem with language, is that we have to kind of explode our definitions.
I was just wondering if there wasn't a better term for it, that's all, that we could put in English to make it
a
little more.
We could just keep saying logos.
Well, then everybody has to go look up that.
Oh, that's right.
So just addendum to that, for the people like me who are really slow, you two are getting each other here. Would you go through the paragraph or the steps that explain the many levels of logos?
I that's really out of my level of competence. I can say this, though. In philosophically, it means like the intelligent principle that's the unifying element of the universe. It's that broad, in its broadest sense of the word, the intelligence principle that's the unifying force of the universe. But it's also, you know, from the Hebrew scriptures, the concept of word is a dynamic thing. It's not a static thing. It's actually something that's got power behind it. So God spoke and it came to be. In the beginning of the Gospel of John, John is borrowing Greek philosophical terms, and he says, which is kind of a scandal for the Greeks to hear, because for like somebody like Philo of Alexandria, who's a contemporary of Jesus, the word is the go-between between the perfect being God and the imperfect universe. Because the perfect God cannot come in contact with the muddy universe. So the logos is the go-between. So you can imagine the horror when they hear that the word was with God, the word was God, and the word had dirty diapers. Because the God is not supposed to come in contact with the universe. That's at least one understanding of it. So it's one of these very multi-leveled words. For us, the word is that. It's this intelligence principle that's the motivating intelligence behind the universe. And all of that is somehow summed up in this person, Jesus.
Yeah. And they managed to put all that in four letters. Well, good for them.
Again, it's the problem of language in general. Yeah. Like love. You know, I love ice cream and I love somebody, but they're not the same love, you know.
And it's very eye-catching, that first sentence, but you have to dwell on it. You
yeah,
have to
that's right.
really work on
that's
it before
right.
you go any further.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello.
Hi.
From psychology, I can just comment on one other notion of the word, and that is the unthought known.
Mm.
The idea that, and as I get older and words elude me, it's comforting to know there is such a thing as knowing without a thought.
Yeah.
As iterated one more way, without the word,
yeah.
Just to know it. Mm. But the question I have is, in your work, your interfaith work, how do you deal with the phrase "the only begotten Son"?
I'm going to jump right in the deep end here. Orthodox Christianity holds that, believes that, teaches that. The phenomena that is the historical Jesus is the fullness of divinity dwelling in Jesus bodily. And Orthodox Christianity does not believe that that phenomena had happened before. Nor does Orthodox Christianity believe that that happens naturally with anybody else, that this was a supernatural, gratuitous act of the divine. So that's how I understand what that phrase means. I think it's a pretty safe but also broad definition of the only begotten Son.
I was wondering if you could treat it much like most favored nation.
No, I don't. I see. I'm trying desperately not to be. It's, you know, the even Pope Benedict, you know, a stalwart of conservatism, would say that Jesus is not just historical Jesus, but Jesus is the Christ event. If there's an event there that we believe was a unique event. Trying to understand that is like trying to only use one level of meaning of the word logos. I mean, the problem is our words trying to describe. I mean, what the heck does it mean that the fullness of divinity dwells in somebody bodily either? It's the closest. We're just like toy bears banging on cracked drums trying to make some sense of this phenomena. It doesn't mean that there weren't other holy people or enlightened people, but there's something very unique that the Orthodox Christian tradition believes happened in this event that is Jesus Christ. Whether I agree with that or not is not the issue, but even maybe at some point Orthodox Christianity is my dialogue partner as well. But I do believe that's kind of the center of Orthodox Christian teaching. Is anybody at all satisfied with that answer? That's right. Thank you.
Hi.
Hi.
When you mentioned your profound impact when you touched the wall,
yeah.
You know, it instantly reminded me of the very book we are studying now about morphogenic fields,
yeah.
which... And I haven't finished the book, so I'm no expert in it, but what I remember as a field of information, a field that holds a memory.
Yeah.
And so you reacted to the pain that the field possibly holds around the wall. Mm. And it was passed to you instantly. And David Rico, who speaks here, when he went, he fell on the ground and was just crying, hysterically, you know, it hit him like that. So, going from there, I was at Congress and I heard an Irish priest and his associate, a deacon, talk about Belfast, and I'm getting to your work with interface. When I heard him, I couldn't help thinking that it's almost hopeless, the hatred that has gone on for 700 years. And it hit me again. What if there is a morphogenic field that holds hatred memories? and that are forever holding people in their grasp. And then I thought, how can inner faith work when you deal with centuries of perpetuated violence in certain areas? I really walked out of there because of this awareness of a morphogenic fields. I go, this is hopeless. Eight-year-olds grabbing stones, throwing them, not knowing why they spontaneously do it. So I want to know if you felt anything like it, if you, when you went to areas, including Jerusalem, where there's a lot of conflicting stuff going on, violence, pain. If there's something to these fields, and apparently the memory is alive for, I mean, our book tells things where 2,700 years the memory is alive, and there was proof, even in birds, you know.
Yeah.
So anyway, I thought, what is your thought on that?
That's a very, very important point and a huge topic, I think. I mean, I came back from the trip to the Holy Land, and I think almost immediately wrote like 4 or 5 songs. I was never so bothered and inspired by something as I was then, on many different levels. Let me see where to jump in. First thing I want to jump in is you said hopeless, and that's a good word to use. I'm not allowed to use that word because I'm a Christian, and so I'm a man of hope. So I can't be hopeless, but I don't have to be optimistic. And that somehow is the difference. There's a great thing, you could look it up online, I think somewhere, you know, Cornel West, the philosopher from, I guess he's still at Princeton, or he's somewhere in the East Coast. He said, optimism is a secular term. Hope is different. Hope's a virtue. And he says something like, I'm a blues man. I'm a man of hope. I'm always going to be a man of hope. Optimism, is a secular construct, but hope is the virtue. So I'm going to die a man of hope. All the same, things don't look too good right now. So, and actually, that's the difference, you know. And like it's really easy to be a peacemaker from our comfortable homes in middle-class America. But you sit in the middle of it and you realize, and just like I said about it, it was so, you know, fun to do interreligious dialogue with Hindus and Buddhists, you know, from the hot tubs in Santa Cruz. But to be in Lebanon and to still see the walls shot out with bullets and to have interreligious dialogue meetings with not one Jew present and to sit at the home of a Sufi master and him point to the Golan Heights and say, that's ours. And I was doing a concert in Aleppo in Syria, and because I said the word Israel as the title of a song, people walked out of the church. Yeah. So I agree with you. Yes, I think that, and I think that sometimes in our, this is the part you're not going to like, sometimes in our evolutionary optimism, we don't factor in the morphogenetic field of evil. And that is the thing where I feel like sometimes we're a little lacking, we're a little light, because we have such luxury, we have such comfort. The saying that I hear all the time in California that I just can't bear anymore is, it's all good. It's not all good. Because other things are evolving at the same time. For example, how long do you think it's going to take us to undo the damage of slavery in this country? How long? How long do you think the world is going to suffer from our invasion of Iraq? I could just go on and on and on and on. How long is Germany going to carry the weight of the Holocaust? All these things. And how long are we going to ignore the fact that our carbon fuel-based way of living is destroying the planet? We still haven't woken up to that. You know, while the polar ice cap is melting and 20,000 species have been wiped out, it's all good. It's not all good. It's really not all good. So I agree with you, but I cannot say I'm not a man of hope.
Henry Nouwen, who devoted his life to the mentally ill, he saw in it all the time the paradox that it's through the challenges of suffering and violence that paradoxically hope is born.
Or so, not.
Or not, yeah.
Unfortunately, also or not.
But then you have a guy like Greg Boyle, you know, who faces it head on, and there's great hope things. So there's a tension there that seems to be alive at all times. It's a matter of which way more, you know, which will outweigh the other one. So
And that's where the virtue of hope comes from. But the virtue of hope is not wish. It's not like I hope I have a nice lunch. That's I wish. Hope is somehow rooted both in faith and in love, and it's a seed that doesn't die. It's not supposed to ever die in us because it's a virtue that gets that's poured into us, but it's a gift of the Spirit, really.
So, anyway, that Henry Nouwen, I think, went to the depth of it. He understood that, I don't know, that I just feel it there, you know, that there's this paradox at all levels, but it will take some great heart.
Yeah, and the response to it, and I have lots of idealistic young guys who come by the monastery all the time, and I'm so glad they come. I never want to shoot their ideals down. But while they want to go out and slay the dragons, I tell them, okay, that's good, but at my age, what I want to do is build something new. So to me, that's the thing I try to inculcate in them, especially the idealistic ones that come. I say, okay, but I want to build something new. There's only so much time I'm going to waste in anarchy.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of time I'm going to put into taking care of my brother who's got congestive heart failure. There's a lot of time I'm going to spend into making sure we're growing our own vegetables. There's a lot of money I'm willing to put into solar energy to get off the grid. So that's my response. My response is to not ever give up hope, to keep proclaiming it even when it doesn't look too good right now, and also to build something new. We actually have to incarnate. We have to manifest that in a different way of living. And that's, to me, what monastic life is about from the very beginning.
And it may come from the monastic tradition. A woman in India who decided to, which was very un-Indian, she became a prison guard, and from there worked her way up to leading the prison systems in India. She introduced meditation in the worst prisons. And out of that, violence went down. Boom, you know. So I think it will take some different thinkers.
Yeah. Okay. But, good. Yeah. Thank you. Please be fair.
To respond to just the last speaker and the comments around Northern Ireland and the south of Ireland. I'm from Ireland, and I suppose have lived through many generations in our country of hatred and jealousy. And I remember singing at the peace line when the Dalai Lama was there, and the peace line had to be moved because it was in the wrong position. So, you know, it's a very tentative line. But I do think that music offers a great way to cross boundaries, and I do think that music travels to the cave of the heart. I've had the opportunity to work in Bosnia and Kosovo during and after the war as well, and the people had stopped singing. And I suppose what I'm interested in hearing about or asking you about is, you know, that sense of the one note that brings us back to God. And the one note that in some way connects rather than divides. And my sense is that, you know, beyond the separation that occurs through culture, through conflict, through religion, that deeper than that, there's a source of one note. And sometimes I wonder, is that one note silence? Is it breath? What is it that actually connects us through sound?
I would always fall back, since you talk about the one note in the silence, I always fall back on that beautiful Indian teaching about the Om.
Yes.
You know, that... I don't remember exactly what Upanishad is, which Upanishad it is that says this, but I'll get it pretty close. Like, any word falls when it's trying to describe the divine.
Yes.
But the word that comes closest is Om.
Yes.
And the idea of it, it's from that great silence, it's the first sound that issues forth. And it's, in a sense, it's like St. Paul's groaning of creation. It's the sound of creation coming into existence.
Yeah.
And, you know, like when Ramana Maharshi had his enlightenment experience, that om, that sound, mm-hmm. that awareness became, he called it a shruti. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Naren uses that shruti box. Mm-hmm. And it's, this is a drone. Mm-hmm. So he was never without hearing the sound of that. Mm-hmm. Or whatever that word sound means at that level. Never without awareness of that primal ground. And I think that's why meditation is so important, even in interreligious dialogues. Mm-hmm. All the work that I did on the road for 10 years always had meditation and silence involved in it, even mm-hmm. if it was music, even if it was a conference, mm-hmm. because that's also the ground we share.
Yeah.
It's the ground of our being. And this is, again, going back to strict Roman Catholic Thomistic mm-hmm. theology. Mm-hmm. God is not a being. Mm-hmm. God is being.
Mm-hmm.
So when we discover being itself, everything that exists only exists by the grace of sharing and being. That's the thing we share. And that's, yeah, to me, that's why also the music is supposed to lead us to the silence and come from that yeah. silence and try not to offend it too much.
Yeah. Yeah.
Father Lucien Dess, I worked with, used to say, the sound of the music you make must be as good as the quality of the silence you break.
Yeah.
And most music doesn't sound like it comes out of silence.
But it's the God, I think also that, as you say, it's the God of being
yeah.
through us.
Yeah.
It's almost that vision of God
yeah.
that is right being breathed through us in who we are. And I think we do have the shadow, we have the light.
Yeah.
And there's something about making that commitment and that choice.
Yeah.
And to, you know, and also just come from Congress. And another part of Congress, what we were just singing was, live in hope. For nothing is impossible with God.
Yeah.
Nothing is impossible.
That's beautiful.
With God. Yeah.
Thank you.
So, yeah, thank you. I think I have to head off to Ireland.
Yeah.
So I've really been very blessed
okay.
to have been here. Thank
Likewise.
You very much. Skirmagat.
Say thank you. Safe travels.
I was born and raised in Ireland. And in reference to the north-south situation, I remember distinctly the very first... Southern Irishman that died, his name is South, Sean South. And prior to the occurrence of it, my father was disdaining the whole issue that, and in those days before Sean South was killed, they were just going up and making messes, painting walls, and, you know, being rude to the police and so forth. And then they somehow got their heads crazy and thought they'd raid an empty guard house. Unfortunately, it wasn't empty. So one of the guards shot Sean Todd. We had the beginnings of the violence. But my father's transition from being not involved, but disgusted with the shamefulness of it. He was in the front lines of at the funeral because Sean Todd came from my hometown. And I was shocked that he went from, you know, what I considered the white side over to the black side mm-hmm. and a supporter of it. And at that time, I made the decision that I would not put it in my memory anymore. I just decided that I would not participate. I would not look at the past. I would not. Mm-hmm. And I knew it, know the history backwards. But I would not, just not. I made the decision that that was not going to be part of my life.
Mm.
And as I have come along in years, I've decided on everything that has been of a negative nature, a darkness back there, I walk forward.
Mm.
I make the change and I walk forward.
Mm.
My nephew was down in Rwanda, Burundi, after the situation down there, and he came back, and amazingly he came with the same thought. We cannot think of what has happened. We have to think of what we can do.
Mm.
The same thing in the Balkans. It's forward, not backward. And that's what Jesus says.
Mm.
Don't look to the past.
Mm.
And we have that propensity of making a decision that we're going to entertain this stuff.
Mm.
This negativity that comes behind us.
Mm.
And I firmly believe that's part of our necessity to grow, to learn, to decide to do exactly what we're called to do. And that's create for that tomorrow. And to create something good. And especially for those of us who are conscious of the goodness that we're learning. Called compassion. So now we take what we have and we move forward. Not looking over our shoulders for remission or correction or apologies or anything. But just to go forward. And that's what I heard you singing. That's what I heard you saying.
Good.
It's to look forward.
Thank you.
Thank you. I wanted to share an experience in Jerusalem where I went with a recent son-in-law and my daughter, who is a Jewish scholar, and had an incredible trip through the whole Holy Land. And I had this experience of the possibility of that sacredness that is portrayed and had the expectation that I was just going to be enveloped and swallowed up into it, and had this really heavy awareness that this group right here could change the world. They had the three major religions were there. If they could just come together, but what I saw was so much negativity among them, even in their rituals and in the way of the cross. And so it was overpoweringly heavy for me. And when I came back, I still, that was with me. And it evoked a lot of prayer and a lot of reflection and meditation. What's been coming to me is the reality, and Dawn mentioned what we've had in this course of intention, the power of intention. But something that's come to me is that there was so much dark energy there. And what's been coming to me is maybe the clue to tapping into that dark energy is in all of us. The dark energy seems, there's a dark energy in the world of negativity. And the power of love in that situation, I could just visualize if those three groups, instead of irritating each other and of putting forth that, if all of us had that kind of intention of opening, of ridding ourselves of the dark energy of the past. I can't quite dismiss it as easily as Peter. The past is with us. The hope is ahead of us. But the reality we're in, it seems to me that we have power. We really have power to change wherever we are. And the Jerusalem, to me, opened up another deeper awareness of the possibilities and the limitations.
And my favorite images of the reign of God in Jesus' parables are always those elements that act by permeating and disappearing, you know, like salt in the earth, yeast in the dough, or the seed that falls to the ground and dies. And I'm convinced that this is who we need to be in the world, where when we're supposed to be salt and yeast and the seeds, we're supposed to be the presence of that. And that, that's why doing our inner work is just as important as doing our the outer work.
It was such a power to feel that energy.
Thank you very much. And like you were saying about those groups, you know, there together being able to change the world. I mean, I did, Judith talks about, you know, the international travel, and it's really true, but quite often I was singing for, you know, 6 to 20 or 30 people, these little events, really all over the world. But doing the same thing pretty much I'm doing with you here, I thought it was the most important thing in the world that I was doing. Just singing songs, telling stories, teaching people how to meditate, it felt like as important as anything anybody was doing in the world. Because I think it's that interchange that, and it's part of the evolution of consciousness that has to happen. Yeah, I agree. Please, Ernie.
First, heartfelt God bless you.
Thank you.
Just wanted to thank you for an insight that occurred to me a few minutes ago when you were talking about Ramana Maharshi and Om. Mm. You mentioned that he said that he's never without hearing that sound. He never does not hear it.
Yeah. And I'm not sure if he used the word hearing, but it was like his awareness of it never went away.
It occurred to me when you said that, that the sound that I'm never without hearing is my tinnitus.
Oh.
What occurred to me is the possibility of trying to meditate on that as Shruti and see what happens. So, thank you.
Okay. I think it's a very, very positive spin to put on it. Uh-oh, it's going to get ugly here.
I don't think so. Early this morning, you used the word contemplation.
Yeah.
And in one of our chapters in the book we're studying, the author says there are four stances I think will help us with creating the field of compassion on Earth. And one she mentions is contemplation. And she says, an old definition of contemplation is taking a long, loving look at the real, attending to what is before us free from inattentional blindness. And so I was interested in what you mean when you say contemplation and what your definition of that is.
I've been reading a lot of the Carmelites again recently from some teaching I've been doing, and I'm quite attracted to the phrase and even to the experience somehow of the idea of infused contemplation. That's one of those little jewels we preserve in Christian teaching about prayer and meditation. It's part of our logic and requirements of prayer is that we don't think that height of contemplation as we understand it is not something we can just climb the ladder to do, but it's something that's given to us. But that's also where hope comes in. We wait in joyful hope, expecting that that is what grace wants to pour out on us, and that Judy Kanaro talks beautifully about the reception of the gift of God. That's actually God's own, the ancients would even say God's own eros, God's own longing for connection with us. And the anthropology I was taught, and kind of a spiritual anthropology, contemplative anthropology, takes that a step further to say that that's actually a transformative experience of the entire person. That spiritual awakening then has its flooding, permeating effect on the whole psychic being, which is what we usually call the soul, but also going a step farther, and this is the really mind-blowing thing, that also has its effect on the whole material being. So we just celebrated the Transfiguration last week. That's an icon of it. The Eastern monks especially love that image, that's what could happen, is transformative power, transforming of the whole person somehow. That's the gift of contemplation. But contemplation specifically as that received thing. You know, we can do so much and then we wait. And people talk about Christ consciousness sometimes, and I think in a very cavalier kind of way, as if something you could, you know, order from the back of a yoga magazine or something. But Paul talks about it very clearly. He says you can have the mind of Christ, who did not deem equality with God something to be grasped at, but emptied himself and took the form of a slave. And that's our way, our even our way of meditation, but our whole posture in the world. At meditation, this is very easy for us, Kamaldi's monks, because our founder, St. Romuald, that's part of his brief rule he left us. Empty yourself completely in imitation of Jesus, and sit waiting, content with the grace of God, waiting in joyful hope for that. But then also, this is our posture in the world. Our posture is to be emptied of self and to be absolutely available as Jesus on Holy Thursday with a towel around his waist, as servants and slaves of the world in some way, to be totally of service. That's our way of having dominion.
You're talking about Om. Reminded me that all of us on many levels, when we have wrestled with something and we come to understanding, we say, oh.
And I found out, I think I wrote about this in the book too, I found out that so many of my favorite prayers began with the words, oh my, oh my. Oh my Jesus, oh my God, oh my most gracious Virgin Mary. It was the om at the beginning.
Hi, thank. There's so much here. It's so rich today. It's like, this is too much. I mean, it's so much to wrestle with.
You need a little, what do they have? A little Italian ice to clear the palate after.
Yeah, I'll meet at Baskin-Robbins. I was thinking, when I worked on this Celtic festival at Earl Warren years ago, when they celebrated New Year's, I think it's, is it New Year, or whatever, one of their celebrations, one of the donations we gave to was this sports group from Ireland, where they brought the youth to play soccer from both sides of Ireland, the Protestants and the Catholic, over to the United States. So I agree. I think sports is another way to bring in infusion into these fields, so to speak, and music. So if there's negative fields, why can't we bring in positive energy to these same places?
Yeah. Yes.
That's a rhetorical, but the other thing I want...
Aren't they all? Yeah.
Yeah, but I think, I mean, I'm not just satisfied with saying let it be negative. I mean, we need, like you said, a new way, whether we do it within ourselves, and then through sports and through music, that can just...
Yeah, and our Father Bruno has the phrase, depth anthropology, but that even that depth anthropology can't stay at a notional level. It has to really be incarnate in something. That's why I'm always trying to emphasize this idea of a way of life that's inspired by that and then somehow incarnates that and manifests that. And so, yeah, I think you're right, both athletics and music and the arts, they're all very concrete, they're all very incarnate. I was telling our friend from Ireland about sitting with these boys singing at Glenstall Abbey, and from hearing the stories from other traditions and then for them to sing them with me, suddenly somebody else's text became a part of their own blood and air, you know, and then you start to enter into the experience in a whole new way. It's kind of hard to shoot somebody after you've sung their songs, you know. A little harder anyway. Not impossible.
And my friend and I, we just saw a movie about, what was that movie we saw? It was about the war, First World War, I think, and about how on Christmas Eve they...
yeah, Kristallnacht.
What was it?
Is that what it's called?
It wasn't that one.
The American soldiers... Yeah. I just had the wrong name.
It was incredible because they weren't the same afterwards.
Yeah,
because they shared. They shared their life and the cat. That each had a different name for the cat.
Yeah.
So these are seeds that are going around. Would you tell us a little bit about Father Bede Griffith and about the Kamal Dalis?
Sure.
Actually, what you do up there?
What we do up there?
Well, besides pray and how important liturgy is.
A few minutes. Jesus has given me time. Father Bede Griffiths was an English Benedictine monk. Before he converted to Catholicism, he did his degree at Oxford, tutored under C.S. Lewis. Was doing some experiments with very simple living with two other friends of his shortly after his Oxford career, living on the land but also studying the sacred texts of many other traditions. And through a series of different experiences, decided to convert to Roman Catholicism, which he quotes at one point. He said, his mother had said nothing would give her greater pain than if one of her children would become a Roman Catholic. Apparently, that was the religion of the servants, you know, in England. Not that, but he did. He joined Prinish Abbey, but very shortly after getting to Prinish, he met this woman named Toni Sussman, who was a direct disciple of Carl Jung. And she kind of reopened him right away to both the wisdom of the East and also the depth psychology through Carl Jung. Was invited by an Indian Benedictine monk to open a Benedictine house in South India in a city called Bangalore. They were already talking about something, but we know the word now of enculturation, of trying to do it, you know, according to more of the genius of the native Indian tradition rather than just a Western thing. But this first experiment was actually still very Western. He talked about in his video about we still had our white habits and we had our proper silverware and our paper and our cloth napkins and everything. And then he, with another monk from Belgium named Francis Mathieu, started an ashram in the western part of southern India in a state called Kerala, ashram called Kurusamala, where they adopted the Siromalakar rite, the rite that comes out of Syria, that they both felt was closer to the Aramaic and to the Mideastern mindset and the mind of Jesus that way, translated the whole thing into English. That was a successful experiment. Meanwhile, on the other side of southern India, in Tamil Nadu, two crazy Frenchmen had started another ashram called what I just mentioned, Satchitananda Ashram, Shantivanam, in Tamil Nadu. One of them died not long into the project. The other one was Omri Lasso Abhishekananda, who really had quite a yen to be a wandering sannyasi instead and was spending more time up in the Himalayas. And they asked, Omri Lasso asked them from Kerala to take over Shantivanam, and Bede was sent there to do it. And under him, Shantivanam became very successful as a center, really, of dialogue, starting out mainly between Hinduism and Christianity. They referred to it as a Hindu-Christian ashram, because his notion was that an ashram, part of its purpose is to have the open walls where people from any tradition can come. Also with this idea that the monk is different from the priest in the sense that the difference that between like a Brahmin priest and a sannyasi, because the sannyasi of India is the one who's gone beyond all rituals, gone beyond all name and beyond all form, wouldn't be involving himself with, you know, ritual and sacrifice and hymns, but would be concentrating mainly on meditation. He was trying to rekindle that also in Christian monasticism as the desert monks would be. So anyway, it was very successful on him, and he wrote most of his books from there and traveled all over the world teaching of that. Our connection with him is that toward the end of his life, in the 1980s, he brought himself and all the monks of Shantivanam into our congregation, the Kamaldolese. And then, just before he died, he came his last trip to the United States. He set up his archives at Big Sur, at our monastery, and that was actually when I was entering, and I got to meet him. Just that one time. Well, he was there for a couple of days, but I heard him give one talk, and that just changed the whole trajectory of my own, or at least set the whole trajectory of my own monastic life, where I started studying Eastern mysticism, Western mysticism simultaneously, even as a postulant and novice, and all the way through. And I'm still staying on the same themes I got from him. The Kamaldolese, based in Italy, turn of the century, St. Romuald dies in 1027, mainly known for the fact that St. Romuald brought the Eremitic tradition back into, maybe for the first time in an organized way, into Western Benedictine monasticism. But he both founded and reformed monasteries, and also were gathering these disparate groups of hermits that were living all over the hills of Italy, and put them also under the rule. So they were called the sensible hermits that lived under the rule. It's true. True story. If you can believe there's such a thing as a sensible hermit. But some of our early monks were also sent, the first disciples of St. Romuald were sent up into Hungary and Poland, which were a very hostile pagan, excuse the word, lands at the time, and were murdered for it. So the whole vision of our early days was what we call now the threefold good of solitude, community, and this, we don't want to name this third thing, but it's something like missionary martyrdom. It was sometimes called Evangelium Paganorum, the evangelization of pagans, or sometimes just called martyrium. And it's that dynamic of that we call as the charism of our congregation. This third one isn't played out too much, but that was part of my inspiration to do so much work in interreligious dialogue. And I know there are a number of Anglicans in the room, so hopefully you'll think this is funny and not take it as an insult. But our former prior is also a former Anglican. And he said, it's not just sipping tea with our Anglican friends in the parlor. The third good is really some kind of, like I said about talking about Hinduism and Buddhism and Santa Cruz in the hot tub is one thing, but going to the Holy Land and actually being in the midst of a place where the walls are riddled with bullets. So that's also somehow part of our charism that we're not sure exactly what the church and the world are going to ask of us for that for now. So at New Kamaldolese, we were started in 1958. We our biggest house is that one. It's a hermitage, which may have more romantic notions than it deserves. We live a semi-communal and semi-solitary life. We have four liturgies a day together and one meal a day required of everybody together. And the young monks especially have much more communal time with classes and work and things like that. But there's a beautiful dynamic, you know, many monks, there's a wide dynamic of how much solitude and how much community one needs and one wants, depending on the area of formation. We also now have two satellite houses, a house in Berkeley with four monks and a house in San Luis Obispo that we've just accepted as a dependent house. It's a four monks there. So. Is that it's a thumbnail sketch. Is that enough? For
I just wanted to add one little thing before we close. Back in, we just passed St. Patrick's Day. Well, that was in the 5th century. Shortly after that, Europe went into the Dark Ages for 400 years.
Yeah.
And it was the Irish that brought, the Irish monks, the Irish...
I know. Saved civilization.
Brought them... No, don't laugh. They did.
No, it's the name of the book. I read it.
Everybody should read it.
Okay, people are leaving. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay.